You made it to a Thursday here on Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you are spending time with us today. Coming up in the second half of today's show, our weekly in-house podcast about the legislature that's in session, plus Dave Thompson will review the news, and Matt Olean stops by the Main Street studio, and he'll review the movie that's done well at the box office, and that's Thunderbolts. Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and today we're joined by our good friend, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota, and author of the new book, Israel, Palestine, and The Trolley Problem, on the futility of the search for the moral high ground. Jack, welcome back to Main Street.
Oh, I'm always happy to talk to you, and I love being on Main Street.
Jack, this is a very interesting book about a centuries-old problem. The title I just read, what inspired you to use the trolley problem as a metaphor in the Israel-Palestine conflict?
I found it very frustrating to hear people talk about the war. Everyone started with a conclusion. Their team was right and argued to find any way to justify that position. It wasn't about truth. It wasn't about morality. It really wasn't even about empathy and consideration. It was about, how do I find the cracks in the other person's perspective to use those cracks to claim moral superiority? And so I found the trolley problem.
Let's remind our listeners what the trolley problem is.
Actually, I want to step back from that question for a second, because I think that there's an important preparation to make, because our listeners know me very well, which is, when I'm on Y Radio, I'm advocating for the listener and celebrating the guest's research. When I'm on Philosophical Currents with you, we're engaged in a joint experience of discovery, and I'm trying to pull the audience along to include that, to inspire that sense of wonder. But this is a book that I'm writing in my own name, from my own voice, and from my own perspective. And I needed to do that because it was tearing me apart. Because the war is terrible, the way it inspires conversation is terrible, and nothing positive is coming from any of it. And so I needed to get this out of my system. I needed to get this off of my chest. I just needed to write it down so I could give it to other people, so I could give it to students, so I could put it online for free for a download, and be able to say, if you want to have this conversation, here's what I have to say. Let's talk about it. And the thing about the trolley problem is that it is this really nice intuitive picture at people are very familiar with, that inspires both the silliest of memes online and the most sophisticated of academic articles. The basic setup: the driver of a trolley, and there are two tracks. One track is a bunch of people tied up who you're going to run over, and the other track is something else. Maybe it's fewer people, maybe it's a baby, maybe it's a box that contains the secret to life, universe, and everything. And you have to decide which one to pick. It is decision in the face of tragedy, and it is a question about moral responsibility and agency. What do you do when you're in control and when other people are affected by your decisions?
You argue there's no moral high ground in the Israel-Palestine conflict. Explain why you believe that neither side can claim moral superiority, and that neither side can win, and what win means.
There are a couple different attitudes about what winning means in the war. The first is from an extreme Israeli perspective that has been echoed by Donald Trump and others, which is, let's finish them off. Let's wipe all the Palestinians off the land. There is a more moderate position that comes from that side, which is about a two-state solution. And can these two peoples live together in, you know, adjacent countries? The problem with that, of course, is that once there are two countries, the second one attacks the other, it all starts over again. Then from the Palestinian side, there's the more extreme position of, let's wipe all the Israelis off the planet. Let's get rid of Israel. Let's take our land back, which has certain assumptions about land that is worth talking about. And there's the more moderate which is let's have a two-state solution, let's live together, but they're all of these people who have been born and raised in this conflict. Most Palestinians are under 30 years old. A huge portion, at least half, are under 18. They don't know peace. They've watched their families die. They've experienced the most traumatic experiences in the world. And they're full of anger and fear and hate for very understandable reasons, just as many Israelis who are the victims of terrorism and the victims of attacks themselves have seen horror and trauma and lost people and are full of anger and frustration and often hate. So what it means to win is almost always an inescapable scenario. The two groups have always acted at their worst and have backed themselves in a corner where the only solution is further decimation. And the only solution is mass killing, disregard for human life, and a sense of moral superiority that needs to be unpacked and discussed. It's a bleak picture. And it's a frustrating picture. And what I wanted to do was not find a solution to the war, but find a better way to talk about it, especially philosophically. To have a philosophy book that isn't about public policy, that isn't about international relations, but that's about what morality means, how we think about morality, and how to talk about and negotiate morality with other people.
Let's go back to the trolley problem for just a moment. One of your key points is that the conflict, I think, has become a psychological trolley problem rather than a philosophical one. What do you mean by that?
I'm really glad you brought that up, because one of the issues with the trolley problem is that it's been reduced to its simplest form. It's a question about what philosophers call utilitarianism. What are the consequences of a moral problem, and which are the best or worst consequences? So from a utilitarian perspective, you do the math, right? This side kills five people, the other side kills three people, the three people win. But that's not how I learned the trolley problem, and that's not my understanding of it, and that's not the roots of the problem as depicted by its creator, Philippa Foot, a philosopher who wrote in the 1960s. For her, and for the way it was taught to me, it was about active versus passive responsibility. So when I first learned it, there was actually only one track, and people were tied to the track, and you had this big guy that you could push onto the track and derail the trolley and save these other people. And so the question wasn't, do you kill one person to sacrifice many? The question was, do you stand aside and let history take its course and have no responsibility or accountability? Or do you get involved and be responsible for the negative consequences? How much responsibility do we have to intervene? And how much responsibility do we have to be an active rather than a passive participant? This is super interesting and super important because it also connects to our attitudes about euthanasia and assisted suicide. American doctors are of the position that you can let someone die as long as you're not pressing the button, as long as you're not killing them. If you let nature take its course, you are innocent and people can go off the machine themselves or refuse treatment. You're innocent and free. But what you're not allowed to do is give them an injection, cover their face with a pillow, press the button. You can't be responsible for someone else's death. There's something understandable about this and strategic about this, but there's also something disingenuous and dishonest about it, because it's like saying, hey, I didn't get involved, so I can't be held responsible. It's an assumption that no action is innocent. It forgets that deciding not to act is itself an act. Choosing to be passive is itself a moral decision. And so what I wanted people to start thinking about was the ways in which their actions and their perspectives and their arguments are accountable for the way we think about and talk about the war and the way we're egging each side on. Every time we claim the moral high ground, we're giving these participants permission to act worse than they are before.
And you mentioned that most public debates about the Israel-Palestinian conflict are not about the actual conflict at all, but about moral posturing of those who are arguing. How did you come to that conclusion? Yeah.
That's right. So someone will say the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, killed a bunch of kids yesterday. Therefore, Israel is bad, must be wiped off the face of the earth. Or someone else will say, well, the Palestinians hide missiles behind civilians. And so the Palestinians are bad, and therefore they should be wiped off the face of the earth. This side lies. That side has propaganda. Therefore, they have no moral worth. They have moral value. And this, it's philosophically indefensible, but it's also strategically bizarre because it makes the argument about a football game, about a tactic, about a way of taking the littlest thing and making it symbolize a most difficult and complex conversations and decisions that we have to make as a human race.
We're enjoying our conversation with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He's written the new book, Israel, Palestine, and the Trolley Problem, on the futility of the search for the moral high ground. And of course, Dr. Weinstein teaches philosophy at the University of North Dakota. Jack, in your view, do terms like genocide and colonialism get misapplied in discussions about Israel? And what's lost when those terms are used?
Thanks for asking that question, because that's a super important part of the book. Because one of the discussions that people have is whether or not these terms are anti-Semitic. And so some people will claim Israel is colonial or acting in genocide, and they'll paint this very simplistic picture and unfair picture of the Israeli perspective. But in return, people who are defending Israel will say, oh, you're being anti-Semitic, you're making these claims, they're unjustified. But no one really has a sense of what anti-Semitism means, and no one really gives a clear answer as to why these terms might be misused and anti-Semitic. And so I explore and explain what anti-Semitism means, and then I use history to pull the threads of these terms, colonialism and genocide. And I want to be clear that just because I'm arguing that genocide and colonialism are the wrong terms, it doesn't mean that we can't have a conversation about war crimes. It doesn't mean that we can't have a conversation about asymmetrical warfare. It doesn't mean that we can't have a conversation about either side acting badly. The problem is that anti-Semitism is often explained in the simplest terms. It means I hate Jews, Jew hatred, stereotyping against Jews. And yes, that's what it means on a certain level. But it's deeper than that. Anti-Semitism is the process of accusing Jews as a whole, the Jewish people, the Jewish ethnicity, the Jewish religion, what often gets termed in the literature, the Jew, capital J, as the worst things in history. So Christianity thinks that the worst thing is killing the Messiah. So what do? They accuse Jews of killing the Messiah. Muslims think the worst thing is killing the prophet. They accuse Jews of killing the prophet. Rural areas throughout history, the worst thing possible is contaminating the water supply. So they accuse Jews of contaminating the wells. Losing your child is a horrible thing. So people accuse Jews of what's called the blood libel, taking Christian children and using their blood to make matzah. You get the picture. And for the current generation, for the discussion of the last few decades, the worst things are genocide and colonialism. We know this from all of the discussion. We know this not just from looking at the horrors of the human race, but we know this about the way that people talk about things. There's a huge discipline, a way of approaching things in universities called post-colonialism. And the assumption is empires are bad, being a colony is being exploited, and therefore our job is to hear the voices of the people who have been oppressed, whether it's India or whether it's slaves or things like that. And I think that's true. I think that colonialism is terrible, and I think that exploiting people and taking over their country is terrible. So people want to attribute this to Jews. Israel is not a colonial state. Jews have lived in Israel since the beginning of time, since Christianity, and we know that because we sing this song at Christmas time, O Little Town of Bethlehem. We know that Jesus was a Jew. We know that Jews have lived in that area for thousands and thousands of years, and that they have as much right to being there as anyone else. I'll come back to that in just a second. We also know that genocide is the intentional destruction of a population because of the existence of the population. And it is built on all sorts of propaganda and claims about the value of people as a human being. And Israel isn't doing that. And one of the signs, and this involves complicated discussion, but one of the signs is that the population of Palestine is increasing at exactly the same rate as the population of Israel. And there's no intent to genocide because Israel isn't operating in those fashion. And that's a complicated, detailed argument that I get into with a lot of historical evidence. What I want to argue is that we don't get any benefit from using these terms, that they complicate the issue, and that we need to have a different conversation because everyone wants to believe the colonialism position. Everyone wants to believe the genocide position because it touches in this anti-Jewish perspective that we have been dealing with throughout history. Again, that doesn't mean that Israel is right. That doesn't mean that Israel can't be criticized. That doesn't mean that Israel isn't guilty of heinous things. It means that these particular things are red herrings. I want us to clarify the argument. I want us to be more precise about the argument. I want us to have a conversation about what it means to live in an area together. I don't think people are wrong when they say that Palestinians got kicked off their land. They did. Farmers lost their land. People got moved out of the area. It's a lot like gentrification. The poor always get stepped on. The powerless always get stepped on. And many, many Palestinians, many, many Arabs lost their land and lost their farms. And that needs to be acknowledged. And advocates from Israel have to be honest about that. And to wave away that concern is profoundly unfair. But it's also the case that the Arab countries that surround Israel in the 1980s took 850,000 Jews who were living in their countries, expelled them, and forced them to live in Israel, thereby doubling the population by their own act. All of these are technical issues. All of these are historical issues. Talking about history on the radio is very, very hard because we need a map in front of us. The point that I'm trying to make is philosophy can be useful here. That if we ask what counts as what's a defensible definition of a term, what counts as good evidence, what counts as a good logical argument, how do you use fallacies, how do you use prejudices, how do you use biases against your opponent? That's the conversation we have to have first. And only after we have the conversation about the discussion can we work to have a solution to the war that is as minimizing as much damage as possible.
So you've written this book. It will be read by folks. And we have both driven by protests, if you will, in Fargo. Likely, I bet you they've been in Grand Forks as well. People trying to make point of what is happening in Gaza. So what is it that you hope that they take away when they read your book before they go out next time to march? To those who we see on television who may end up being arrested or exercising their right of free speech, if they were to look at your book, and they want to maintain their rights, what should they take away?
Well, first of all, I love it when people participate in the political process. And protest is very important, and getting attention is very important. The problem with protests as we see it right now is they're one-sided, and they are people who are advocating for victory in their own terms. The only solution to this conflict is working together. The only solution to this conflict is finding a partnership rather than a competition. And that involves softening your language, softening your point of view, getting into a room and having a conversation and a negotiation with your neighbor, your classmate, your professor, your representative, and figuring out how these two people who are incredibly similar, who have overlapping entwined histories, who are all suffering and dying together, to get these two peoples to recommit to empathy, to commit to using their imagination and giving other people the benefit of the doubt, and to construct a common future that utilizes the best of each group as opposed to the worst of each group. Protest is something that you need to use in order to get attention. It's not something that leads to a solution. I want us to be able to talk to one another, to listen to one another, to love one another. I talk about intermarriage at the end of the book and Israelis and Palestinians having babies together. I want people to understand that being a human being is necessarily interdependent. Being a human being is necessarily interdependent. And what we need is to figure out not how to have hostile negotiations between an angry Israeli government and a terrorist organization like Hamas, but rather how to get the Israelis and the Palestinians and the everyday people to talk to one another and recognize their common humanity.
The nationalistic approach now that we have put ourselves in with the results of the last election is not that, is not the willingness to foster partnerships.
I think you're right. And I think that we are at a very scary time in the world where people are not only feeling more isolated, but they're feeling superior and they have contempt for their neighbors. I always like to talk about the difference between patriotism and nationalism. Patriotism is the idea that you love your country, but nationalism is the idea that your country is the best and superior to everyone else, right? I'm married. I love my wife. I think my wife is wonderful. And she is the right person for me. I hope she thinks the same about me for her. But I would never say my wife is the best. I would never say my wife is better than your wife, partially because it doesn't make sense, but partially because if I convince you to feel the same way about my wife than I do, then you're my competitor, right? That you're going to try to steal my wife from me. Patriotism is a wonderful thing, and it's really important. Nationalism is a posture for war and conflict and hostility. Israel, Palestine, there are many reasons to love their locations, their traditions, their commitments. I think that if it were possible to have a two-state solution, which I don't think it is anymore, unfortunately, that would be the way to go. And then you could have Palestinian citizens who make their nation as good as they want it to be, and you could have Israeli citizens who make their nation as good as they want it to be. But if Israel looks at Palestine and says, we are better than you, and we have the right to step on you, and Palestinians look at Israel and say, we are better than you and have the right to step on you, if they use nationalism, if they use religion, if they use hate, they will never pivot into peace. Peace only works when people understand that they are partners and that their fates are intertwined. We as human beings all share the same fate. That should be the starting point, not the ending point.
Jack, how can people get your book, Israel, Palestine, and the Trolley Problem?
First off, you can get it for free. Just search for it online. Go to my website, jackrussellweinstein.com, but just Google Israel, Palestine, and the Trolley Problem. You will get the place to download it as a PDF. You can share the link with as many people. I wanted it to be open source. I wanted it to be free and accessible. You can also buy a paperback for $7 on Amazon. It's a nice paperback. It feels good in your hand. The profits go to the digital press of the University of North Dakota, which is a nonprofit, wonderful organization that allows people to publish things like this. I want people to read about it and talk about it. Write me if you agree, if you disagree, if it was a good or if it was bad experience. That's what I want. It is really important to me that this become as accessible as possible, and I wanted it to be available for free for download. Just use Google. It's there for the taking.
Jack, I hope it sparks further discussions, reflections, and maybe partnerships. Thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for talking about the book.
still to come on this Thursday edition of Main Street. Dave Thompson and I will review the news of North Dakota. We'll have another episode of our legislative podcast In Session. And Matt Olean stops by the Main Street studio. His review this week is about a movie that's done well at the box office, Thunderbolts. That's all ahead. Stay with us.
This is not the end, my friend, like we were alluding to last week, but this is the way the session ends. Not with a bang, but bagpipes. The 69th legislative session of the North Dakota legislature gaveled out around 4 a.m. on Saturday, May 3rd. On this week's episode, we'll recap the particulars of the property tax relief bill and a few others. This is In Session. Welcome to it. I'm Eric Etheridge.
And I am Ann Olquist. And yes, the session ended with a bagpipe rendition of America the Beautiful. Though in full transparency, that was not the actual bagpiper who performed it for him on the last day of the session. For some reason, it wasn't recorded.
Somebody forgot to hit the record button, I guess.
And which is too bad because he looked so sweet in his kilt, and he was up in the gallery playing America the Beautiful.
And tuneful at 4 a.m. with bagpipes.
I know.
Wow. So, Anne, the last time we talked, the property tax relief bill was stalled. But it made it through and then some. Here's Senate Majority Leader Hoeg speaking on the floor.
We passed today House Bill 1176, which is the most significant property tax relief and reform in the history of the state of North Dakota. Every resident that owns a home is going to get a minimum of $500 of property tax relief and a maximum of $1,600.
Yeah, the big sticking point was how much the tax credit should be. Governor Armstrong, back in January, wanted to more than triple it. Then the Senate came back with $1,250, and then it landed at $1,600. And that's the ceiling. The floor is $500.
Right. So even more than what the governor had proposed, actually. But, Anne, I'm even more curious about this. What about the 3% cap on what local governments can spend from property tax revenue?
That did make it through as expected. The surprising thing was no pushback from people like Senator Beckedahl from Williston, who had concerns about the impact on local governments and its sustainability. Remember, Senator Beckedahl is also a city commissioner in Williston, so he sees firsthand the impact on local government budgets and how it will hit. But he became an advocate for it, and it passed unanimously.
This bill provides two things for tax relief. One, it's meaningful, and two, it's sustainable. Because it's tied to the legacy fund earnings that grow anywhere from $1 billion to $1.6 billion every biennium in its principal with new money, and it has an 8% allocation that helps pay for this, there will be increasing streams of money to continue to pay for meaningful property tax relief in the future.
So I wonder, Anne, why there wasn't pushback on that 3%. Has somebody answered the question, where is that money going to come from for schools, for fire departments, police departments, et cetera, roads?
So the compromise is the rollover. So whatever they don't spend, they can roll over the next 5 years. So you can just keep rolling it over. So it's like if you set yourself a budget and you said, I'm only going to spend $100 this month, and let's say you only spent $60, you take that $40, that becomes $140 next month that you could add to your budget.
So the incentive is living within your means for local governments, and I guess everybody could probably get behind that. Well, speaking of impact on local governments, Anne, Fargo did not win its battle for how it runs its elections. How is the city responding?
Michael Redlinger, the city administrator for Fargo, he talked to our reporter Todd McDonald this week.
As a reminder, we're going back to the conventional procedure that we had in place before, so not hearing a lot on it right now, but I do think that it's going to be a topic that will get discussed again as we get closer to that next municipal election next June.
Okay, Anne, numbers time to close out our next to the last episode of In Session. What is your first?
180 or thereabouts. That's how many students in Williston were quarantined because of a measles outbreak.
Measles, not just in Texas anymore. It has arrived. It's impacting Williston and the schools there. Some quarantining going on. Yikes. What's your second number?
1,500 or thereabouts. That's how many missing persons reports the National Crime Information Center has for Native American and Alaska Native people. I bring it up because May 5th was Missing and Murdered Indigenous People Awareness Day across the country.
And that certainly affects us here. There are a lot of cases that are top of mind and some that don't get enough attention for sure. And it's good to draw attention to that.
And I'm just going to do a shout out to Buffalo's Fire, which is based out of Bismarck. Jody Ray Spotted Bear.
Oh, awesome. Yeah.
The website was red. Red is the color that signals that you are aware of missing and murdered Indigenous people around the world. And they have a really wonderful gallery to say their names and show the pictures of murdered and missing people in North Dakota.
And my number, Anne, is one, as in one special guest for our last in-session podcast episode. You know him, Rob Port. I bet you read him, too. He's a columnist, and he's a podcaster, too, of Plain Talk. He will be our special guest in Fargo May 22nd. We'll hear some analysis about state politics, get the latest on the fallout from the Ray Holmberg sentencing, and we'll hear his take on the future of media, as well as his analysis on the just-wrapped 69th legislative session. It's going to be fun. You'll get to ask questions, too. Tickets are free but very limited. Check out prairiepublic.org for details. Should be a lively good time. Hey, hope you enjoyed this week's episode of In Session. Tay Calloway is our radio studio operator. Christine McClellan is our communications manager. And Leah Peterson is our digital communications specialist. I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Ann Olkos. Hope to see you May 22nd in Fargo.
Now joins us again on Main Street. It's Thursday. That's the day we review the news of the state and the region. Dave, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks, Craig. Good to be here.
Before we get into the news, Dave, of course, the legislature has just wrapped up their session. Mm-hmm. Tell me, Dave, in your mind, what are the most important issues that they'll be working on in the interim?
I think you'll see a lot of, shall we say, work done on the property tax relief. They're going to be asking for some reports. They're going to be seeing how that's working out, especially the 3% caps on local property tax hikes, because I know some local governments have some angst with that. So that's one of the big things. Secondly, you're going to see, I think, more effort now that they've got property tax relief done. There will be another effort to try to reduce more on income taxes. You'll see that, too. There were blatant attempts, or shall we say, attempts, not blatant, to try to do that during the session using some existing bills, but they didn't get very far. You'll watch that, and there's going to be a study on that. And one of the things that the legislature did pass was a North Dakota DOGE, but they're going to do it the right way. They're going to basically get representatives of the executive branch, the legislative branch, the judicial branch, and they're going to find out ways they can cut the budget. So that'll be an effort that's going to take at least 2 years.
We'll keep our eyes certainly looking towards the interim and the work that the legislature continues
Absolutely.
To do.
Absolutely.
Two big stories, though, Dave. The measles outbreak in the Williston area. Now 180 students are under quarantine. There have been 9 reported cases, and I assume that number will rise. What's the latest?
And I think you've got it right there. We're expecting the number will rise because some of the people who were infected actually attended schools, and they found that out, and that's why a number of schools had to tell students, if you were in contact with these infected students, you're going to have to go home for a while. 180 students out of 3 different schools have to quarantine for a while. So that's going to be an interesting discussion there, because are they allowed to do things online? We think that's going to happen. Or will they have to make up some of those days?
Another story you're keeping an eye on are fires now that are a big deal in North Dakota. We have dry weather for sure. Fire weather has caused the activation now of the State Emergency Operations Center.
That's
correct. What's involved there?
So what happens is they have 4 different levels. 0, they don't activate. But 2, they activated because they're asked for some state resources to help fight some of these wildfires in some of the areas, especially in the Turtle Mountains, because that's a very woody area, and they're worried about, you know, fires getting out of control. So they can bring some state resources to bear. When it gets to four, then the entire National Guard is going to be called, or at least put on alert, to help with those fires. But right now it's at two, so they're kind of watching things. And, of course, the next forecast for the next day does not look good, because for western and north central North Dakota, there's a fire weather watch out right now.
It's dry and the wind's going to blow and there's no rain in our near future, it seems to me.
That's correct. And they're talking about a thing called dry thunderstorms, where lightning bolts may hit some of this dry grass, but there's no rain because the rain will evaporate before it gets to the ground.
Well, Dave, let's turn the keys, hit the accelerator, and go to Bismarck at 80 miles an hour come August 1st.
Amazing, isn't it, that they tried this for a number of sessions. Finally, it got through both houses this time, and the governor did sign it. So they're talking about 80 miles per hour, but there will be increased fines for speeding to go along with that. Plus, there's going to be a report about these increased fines. Have they actually caused drivers to stay within the speed limit or what? So they're going to be doing a lot of study of that over the next 2 years as well.
As the legislature died down, there was an effort to improve North Dakota campaign finance reporting, but that ultimately failed. Will there be work on this in the interim?
Absolutely, there will be work on this in the interim. There will be a study on that. That was one of the more interesting debates that I listened to. It went for 90 minutes in the House. They were pointing fingers at the Senate about how you change our bills on campaign finance reform, and in the end, it just died. It's off the table for that session. Now it's going to be on the table for legislators to study.
Dave Thompson and I, we review the news each and every Thursday here on Main Street. Dave, it's always great to visit with you.
Thanks,
enjoy
Craig.
The weekend.
Hey, you too. Appreciate it.
There's a fanfare. That means it's Thursday, of course, here on Main Street. Pleased to welcome back Matt Olean, our in-house movie reviewer extraordinaire. Awesome. Good. Well thought through. All those kinds of things.
Oh, my
Matt,
goodness.
How are you?
My goodness. I'm good. Better after that introduction.
Yeah. The movie this week is Thunderbolts. Let's hear the trailer.
Being a hero, there is no higher calling. Your sister understood something about that.
I should have come back for you.
No. That's just a fairy tale.
I was in high school when the Avengers came. Kind of strange that it's all over now. No one's coming to save the day.
I think we are. We can be the ones that are coming.
Buck, you have the wrong people. We have all done bad things.
Look, I've been where you are. The past doesn't go away. So you can either live with it forever, or you can do something about it.
I am a void. Look what you unleashed. You can't outrun the emptiness.
We can't do this. No one here is a hero.
We all have things that we regret.
But I have so many.
All right, Matt. We've heard the trailer of Thunderbolts, the movie that you'd like to review this week, and I'm just wondering if it aligned with everyone's expectations of what a Marvel film is supposed to be.
So it exceeded expectations at the box office, $76 million. That's an opening weekend, and that's an opening weekend without a holiday in there, okay? There's no Friday or Monday off like Memorial Day or 4th of July or Labor Day, that kind of thing. So it exceeded expectations, and I would say in the second iteration of Marvel films, which is pretty much everything after Avengers Endgame, Craig, a lot of them have been disappointing. I mean, this has been the pattern, is try, you know, once they don't have Iron Man, they don't have Thor, they don't have Captain America by, you know, played by Chris Evans, they don't have Hulk played by Mark Ruffalo, where does it go from here? And I think the opinion has been from me and a lot of critics and the audiences since then is kind of a meh, M-E-H, right? Meh. And now I think Thunderbolts is the best post-Endgame Marvel film because it's kind of the getting the gang back. Well, not getting the gang back together, getting a gang together, a band of misfits who name themselves Thunderbolts. And I won't give away the plot point of why they're called that, but they're kind of thrown together. And I think this gets back to what Marvel was really good at with the Avengers movies, some comedy, some humor, some poignancy, but also getting the group together, right? When the Avengers form, people love that on screen. And I think this film, directed by Jake Schreier, exceeds my expectations. Is it the best Marvel film ever? No. But it's way better than Captain America Brave New World, which I reviewed earlier this year, which did not meet expectations. I did not care for that movie. It underperformed at the box office. I really think Anthony Mackie as the new Captain America doesn't work. I don't think he's good enough. But this film, I'll just kind of run down the group. Julia Louis-Dreyfus is the villain. She plays the CIA operative, and she's horrible. She is who knew Dreyfus could play a villain, right, after all her years on Seinfeld? But she does, and she's sneaky, and she's cagey, and she's crazy. And basically, I can't get into a lot of plot points, but basically this group of ragtag individuals are thrown together to try to stop Dreyfus, stop her nefarious activities. Florence Pugh is back as Yelena. We, of course, remember her in Black Widow 2021, which kind of sets this up. Her father is the Red Guardian, played by David Harbour. He's hilarious. He's the funniest part of the movie. He's kind of the Red Guardian, for people who don't know, was the Soviet Union's response to Captain America. He was this super soldier, the Soviet super soldier. But here he's living in America, driving a limousine around, trying to make money. He's overweight. He's old, you know. But he and Florence Pugh are two of the Thunderbolts. Wyatt Russell is John Walker, who's kind of this dime store Captain America. He kind of thinks he's Captain America, has the suit, has the shield, doesn't quite look the part, has a lot of problems. Hannah John Kamen plays Ava. She's kind of the ghost lady of the group. And Sebastian Stan, who is now a superstar in movies, is back as Bucky Barnes, the Winter Soldier. And he's really, I think, becomes the de facto leader of the group. Now, what this group does, how they get together, you got to go see the movie. But basically, I think the exposition is really handled well by Jake Schreier, the director. It forms the group. And really, what's interesting about this movie eventually, Craig, is it's really about mental health. It's about mental health and kind of the void of being depressed, which a lot of these characters share. And certainly a new character, Robert Reynolds, played by Lewis Pullman, fits into this kind of plot point of mental health and how the Thunderbolts kind of figure things out and save the day. They really do it more through mental health awareness, mental health help, and kind of helping each other rather than, you know, any kind of crazy, you know, punching and shooting things like that. So I did like the poignancy of the mental health aspect in this movie. Again, it's hard to explain what I'm talking about because there's so many complicated plot points in this movie. But bottom line is I do think this is a return to form for Marvel. They're setting up future movies with Thunderbolts, the Thunderbolts. And yes, they do have a different name that I won't reveal in the movie. Eventually, they kind of change their name in the movie, and you'll have to go see it, what I'm talking about. But overall, I liked it. The casting was good. But I think what really pulls this film in is Florence Pugh, who's a great actress. She's a phenomenal British actress, and she's marvelous as Yelena, this kind of Russian super spy, super soldier, trained killer. And then her father, of course, David Harbour, so funny as Red Guardian. And also Sebastian Stan, of course, who's a real superstar coming off his Oscar nomination as Donald Trump in The Apprentice, here again as Bucky Barnes, the Winter Soldier, who we first saw in Captain America Winter Soldier 10 years ago.
Matt, there's an asterisk in the title. It's Thunderbolts asterisk. Is there some symbolism there?
There is, and you'll have to go to the movie to see what that means and what it signifies. But basically, it signifies there's going to be more movies with this ragtag group of misfits, and it does mean something, and you have to go see the movie, and a lot of people are seeing this movie.
Now let's go to the Oscar trivia part of our show. Which cast member of Thunderbolts received an Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actress?
That's Florence Pugh in Little Women. I think 2019 was the release year on that, or is it 2018?
It's 2019. Got so it. In okay. the 2020 Academy Awards, who won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress?
Oh, boy. These recent years are always tricky for me. So that was the Parasite year when Parasite got Best Picture. Oh, my goodness. You're stumping me.
I'll give you the name of the movie, sure. Marriage Story.
Oh, Laura Dern. Laura Dern.
We've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 8th. The country was in dire straits when Franklin Roosevelt took office in March of 1933. He immediately declared a 4-day bank holiday and signed the Emergency Banking Act to ease the banking crisis. But there was little he could do to improve the weather. Drought hit the southern plains in 1931. The crops died, and dust from overplowed and overgrazed land began to blow. The number of black blizzards increased, 14 in 1932 and 38 the following year. Some storms blew dust all the way to Washington, D.C. Many factors led to the Dust Bowl. An unusually wet period in the 19th century reinforced the belief that increased farming would lead to increased rain, because rain follows the plow. The Homestead Act encouraged westward settlement. Many settlers had little farming experience and relied on unsustainable practices. After World War I, rising wheat prices drove people to plow up native grassland, leaving behind loose topsoil that was easily blown away. The drought moved into the northern plains, but on this date in 1933, North Dakotans were breathing a sigh of relief. Reports said North Dakota's crop prospects were greatly improved by a general rainfall which occurred over the weekend. Every section of the state saw precipitation. Conditions had been so dry that just half an inch of rain was enough to declare the drought broken. A federal meteorologist said the moisture level was the best it had been in several years. But the optimism was short-lived. Drought conditions continued to worsen. North Dakota struggled into the following year. In 1934, the state was slated to receive nearly $4 million federal dollars to assist farmers. Dr. Walster, Extension Director of the North Dakota Agricultural College, said the state would need twice that amount for drought relief. The Dust Bowl has been identified as one of the worst environmental disasters in U.S. history, with 1934 standing out as the worst year. It caused widespread crop failures, human migration, land degradation, and a permanent change in the social and agricultural structure of the Great Plains. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, it's The Middle with Jeremy Hobson. Jeremy will talk about a topic we've talked about before on Main Street. 35 years after the American with Disabilities Act, what improvements are still needed in society for people with disabilities? At 7 p.m., it's Science Friday with Ira Flato. On Monday's Main Street, we'll visit with Heather Simonich. She's the director of the Center for Holistic Health at Concordia College, and she'll discuss the importance of trauma-informed care and an upcoming free event at the college that talks about the issue. From all of us here at Prairie Public, we hope you have a great North Dakota weekend. And we'll be back right here Monday on Main Street.